This is Bob Lang with the Oral History Project of the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Today is January 14th, 2010. This is the first session with Ann Peckham. And the purpose of this interview is to review the life and career of her husband, Dr. Ben Peckham. So Ann, to start, tell me a little bit about Ben, when he was born and where and who his parents were.
Ben Peckham was born Ben Miller Gross on the 8th of March, 1916. His mother was Mary Peckham Gross, and his father was George William Gross. And when Ben was a young man, he played the violin, and he did this the way he did everything in his life, as a friend of mine said, with all 4 feet. And he got up every morning at a very early hour, driving his brothers insane, and practiced the violin. And when he was a senior in high school, he won the Milwaukee City Music Medal. And he then came to the University of Wisconsin as an undergraduate, and there was no orchestra. So he stopped playing the violin. As he grew up, his grandmother, Elizabeth Peckham, lived with the family. And his grandfather had been a very distinguished educator in Milwaukee. There is a middle school, I believe, that's named Peckham Junior High. He was very interested in history. He and his wife were authorities on jumping spiders. And as little boys, Ben and his brothers and sister were crawling around in the grass out at Lake Oconomowoc looking for spiders. So we never were allowed to kill a spider in our house.
And is that true?
Yes. Well, he taught us that spiders were good things to have. Uh-huh. You know, they eat bugs that you don't want. So his early life was kind of complicated because his mother was a highly intelligent woman. His father had a coal and oil company, and he was an alcoholic. So there were times when Ben and his two brothers, who were each 2 years older than he, they were 2 and 4 years older than he, and they would have to go out and look for father, who had gone off on a bender. And the family lived in a great big house in Milwaukee on Summit Avenue, and mother had a beautiful rose garden. She also had a cousin by the name of Benjamin Kurtz Miller, for whom Ben Peckham was named. And he had a big piece of land, a couple of 250 acres, I think, up on up in Wild Rose on the Pine River. And the boys were, Ben and his two brothers, were taken up there in the summer. And there was a big log cabin. Cousin Ben had by this time died. There was a big log cabin, and they worked the farm. They had some cornfields and stuff like that. They also did a lot of fishing. And Cousin Ben had a tremendous variety of guns. And the boys would go out in the woods and shoot guns. So they got pretty good at shooting guns. And Cousin Ben also had a large library. And by the time the summers were over, Ben had pretty much inhaled the whole library. And of course they were, you know, classics. And this stood him in good stead later on. They, Valentine's Day murders took place in Chicago, mm-hmm. The FBI came up to because they knew that Cousin Ben had a What is that rifle? That, not a rifle, but very powerful.
Revolver?
No, it was a shotgun. And they knew that he had one. And the kids used to go out in the woods and cut down little saplings with this gun. They had a great time with it. But they came up to be sure that this gun was not the one that committed the Valentine's Day massacres. Cousin Ben also had a large stock of wine that he was keeping for whatever reason people keep wine. And by the time they got around to opening the wine, it was all vinegar. So that was sort of disappointing. But anyway, it was kind of a casual youth. The kids were sort of on their own up there in the country. But the family was very devoted. They were very devoted to one another. So Ben came to the university, and he was a good
student. What year would that be?
Well, he graduated from medical school in, I think 39 he graduated from undergraduate.
Okay.
Got his undergraduate degree. He was at the University of Wisconsin for 5 years.
Oh.
He had 3 years of undergraduate and 2 years of medicine. It was at that time the medical school was sending half their class someplace else because they couldn't carry them through. The school wasn't big enough.
And can I ask you, did Ben come to the university expecting to become a physician?
I don't know. It probably was sort of in the back of his mind.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know him, and mm-hmm. we never talked about that.
Mm-hmm.
He lived in the Kaisai house.
Oh.
And he worked. He stoked the furnace.
Oh.
And he used to tell wonderful stories about what he saw very early in the morning coming out of the fraternity houses. Girls in fur coats with nothing on underneath and things like that. It was marvelous. He also, across the way, I've forgotten the name of that fraternity, but there was a fellow there who had a bugle. And he used to blow this bugle at the worst possible times. Ben shot the bugle off his windowsill.
With Cousin Ben's rifle?
Oh, they always had guns, and we had guns. We had we had an array of guns, a 7.57 Magnum also.
Oh.
And Ben would go out to the shooting gallery. I'll get to that later because mm-hmm. he used to take the boys out, teach them how to handle guns.
Mm-hmm.
So he had 5 years at the University of Wisconsin, and then he went, had the great good fortune to go to Northwestern to finish medical school. His mother's cousin, Sanford Gifford, was the head of ophthalmology at Northwestern, and whether that had any bearing on it or not, I don't know, but Ben finished it at Northwestern, and Loyal Davis was the, this is Nancy Davis Reagan's father,
mm-hmm.
brilliant neurosurgeon. And he was the mentor or whatever, counselor or whatnot for the class that Ben was in. And he told Ben that he thought he ought to go into general practice because he would never make it any other way. At the same time, and I think that was a great stimulus for Ben. I think he thought, I'm going to show Loyal Davis that I can do this. So when he finished at Northwestern, he went to St. Luke's Hospital in Cleveland, which I believe no longer exists. And he had his internship there. And immediately, soon as he was finished, he joined the Navy.
Not drafted.
No, he was not drafted.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard, I think, in this day and age. Well, we have an all-volunteer service now.
Mm-hmm.
But there for a while, it was hard to realize that there were people that really, there were men and women who felt, boy, they wanted to sign up. They wanted to
mm-hmm.
to participate. And so Ben spent some time at Great Lakes becoming an officer. He was junior grade, lieutenant junior grade. And then he was sent to Glenview Naval Air Station, which was not far away from Great Lakes. And it was at that, he was there when I met him. Sandy Gifford had been my eye doctor. I was cross-eyed, and I'd been going to him from the time I was 6 years old. Uh-huh. And he had two sons, and he used to call me his favorite girl child. And I think I was such a pathetic creature with these crossed eyes that he sort of felt sorry for me. And he brought Ben over on his birthday. Ben was at their house celebrating his birthday. And he brought Ben over on his birthday to meet the girl that I'm quoting now that he should marry. Huh. I was 18 at the time. I was in nurse's training at St. Luke's Hospital in Chicago. And it just happened, it was a Sunday afternoon, and it just happened that I was home, because it was sort of like going in a convent in those days when you went into nurse's training. We had to be in bed at 10 o'clock, and we had one night a week out, and one night a month at home. And so I was home, and that was really a very lucky day. Because I took one look at this man and I thought, this is a man I like.
Really?
And I had always been very offish with people, so this was sort of a breakthrough. So we saw one another. I could only get out now and then, maybe once every 2 weeks or something, for the next few months. That was March. And in May, Ben was sent off to the Marines. He had learned to fly, because at that time at Navy Glenview, there were a lot of instructors. There were a full complement of physicians, and there were almost no students. And so the instructors wanted to fly. They wanted to get hours in, mm-hmm. So they'd take the doctors and fly them around. So Ben learned to fly. He got his license at Palwaukee Airport, and he said he would like to be a flight surgeon. And they said, fine, we'd like to have you as a flight surgeon, but you have to join the regular Navy. And he said, no, he didn't think he wanted to do that. So they said, all right, you can go to the Marines. So they sent him down to New River, North Carolina, for 3 months of training with the Marines. When he left, he was quite thin, and he was having a marvelous time. The girls on the North Shore had taken these naval officers to heart, and they were well entertained. And my father said, don't cry, he'll never make it. He'll be back here before you know it. Well, he didn't know Ben, so Ben came back, and he had been carrying 100-pound packs and everything else around, because that's the way they trained. They trained just like the Marines, he and his corpsman. So he came home. I think he was here. His family was still in Milwaukee, so we went to Milwaukee, and we decided that it'd be best to wait until he came home from overseas. He wasn't going to be gone long, and they were going to clean up the Pacific. And
what year is this?
This is 1943.
Okay.
And so we decided to wait to get married. And so he went to California, and he called me up a few days later, and he said, I'm coming home. We're going to get married. My mother's getting the ring. and getting my car tuned up, and we're going to drive back to California. Not, is this a good idea, or how about this, but nope, this is what we were going to do. So my poor mother, who had been through a similar situation with my sister a year before, put together a wedding. We were married at home. It was a very, very nice wedding, and
in Chicago,
in our house. We lived at that time on Astor Street in a house, and it was a very nice setting. And of course, my family was there. My sister was my bridesmaid. My grandfather was still alive, so he was there. And my grandmother, my mother's mother, was living with us. And it was really a very, very nice wedding. And we got in the car the next, we stayed the night at the Ambassador Hotel. And we we went down to the dining room for breakfast. And Ben asked for a couple of fried eggs, I guess. And they brought in these little eggs. I've never seen such small eggs, and he never had either. Which he commented on, they must be pullet eggs, says he. Anyway, we got in the car and we went to California. And I was scared to death. I had never spent this much time with somebody I knew as little as I knew this man. So I was afraid to tell him that I needed to stop occasionally for something besides gas. But we ended up in California at Santa Barbara, where Sandy and Alice Gifford had this lovely house in Santa Barbara. And we spent a couple of days there. And Sandy had a cousin that was at Rancho Santa Fe who was in the real estate business. And this, he called him, and this man found us a house in Del Mar on the beach.
Uh-huh.
And so we went down there, and the house, it had four bedrooms and two maids' rooms. It had the biggest dining room table I've ever seen. It was a real party house. And apparently some of the hierarchy in Mexico used to come up and spend the summer up there. Well, the beach was deserted at that point in time. There were nothing but the army fellows out there with dogs patrolling. And everybody was sort of on high alert. You didn't know whether the Japanese were going to make landings. This was a great beach to make a landing on. And it was sort of, there were blackout curtains. We were in blackout at night, and I had no driver's license. So I would take Ben up to camp, and he would tutor me on how to drive all the way up, which was about 15 miles, I suppose.
Which is this Camp Pendleton?
Camp Pendleton, right. And then I'd drive home alone. I finally got a permit to drive. I took a test, but because I hadn't had a permit, they wouldn't give me a license. And I think I turned a corner too sharply or something. They didn't like that either. They're very particular. Well, I think they took one look at me and thought, this is crazy. So I'd go up there. We'd have supper up to camp when Ben had to stay there. And we'd have supper and go to a movie or something. And then I'd drive home in the dark. Now, in the dark was blackout. And you'd get behind a convoy. There were a lot of convoys on that highway down to Del Mar and San Diego. And you'd get behind, and there was a little red light at the end of the convoy. And I could follow that little red light. And, of course, my eyes were better in those days. So that was kind of an interesting experience. And eventually, I did get my driver's license. So we were there for 4 months, and then came the directions on what I was to do when Ben shipped out. And the Navy would come and pack us up, and then there would be a train put together to take all the families back to wherever they came from. And so Ben came home. I've forgotten the date, but it was in January. And I think he knew he was leaving the next morning, but he didn't tell me. He couldn't tell me. And so I took him down to the ship. By this time, they were living on the ships, and just for a few days before they shipped out. So, you know, we knew they were going. I took him down to the ship, and I'd been taking him to camp for 4 months, and he never turned around and waved goodbye. But this day, he turned around and waved goodbye. And afterward, when I went back home, and this young lieutenant who had a terrible job, he was running around telling all the wives their husbands had gone. When he came, I sort of expected him. I thought, there's something going on here. So off they went, and they went to the Marshall Islands.
You did not stay to watch the ship pull out.
Oh, no. Oh, they pulled out in the dark, in the early morning. It was a big convoy. Mm-hmm. I mean, this was the 4th Marine Division. There were 10,000 men. And they were on all kinds of landing craft and that sort of thing. And I guess some of them had a really hard time with seasickness and so forth. But anyway, they went to, excuse me just a second. They went to the Marshall Islands, and they landed on Roy, R-O-I. I believe there were some, in the atoll there were some atomic bomb tests later on. And those that survived got back on the ships, and they went to their advanced base in Hawaii. And they were on the they were camped on the side of Haleakala on the island of Maui. It had been declared uninhabitable for the army, but the Marines lived there, and they were there for I can't tell you how many months before while they refitted the division, and then they got back on the ships, and they went to Saipan. And from Saipan, they went to Tinian. And Ben was a battalion surgeon. He was attached to the infantry. But just before they went overseas, he was transferred to the artillery. And it was a good thing because I don't think there were any infantry doctors that survived those 2 years. So they went to Saipan, and they had a really tough time at Saipan and Tinian. And then they went back to Hawaii, and they refitted again and filled up the ranks. And their last assault was on Iwo Jima. And a lot of the men that Ben had gone over with had been sent home. But they needed to keep some people, some doctors that knew what they were doing, and that had experience on the beach. And so he went to Iwo Jima and survived. And then they went back to Hawaii, and they were refitting and getting ready to go. They were in Pearl Harbor, getting ready to go to Japan when the bombs were dropped and the war was over. So when Ben came home on a troop train, they had been gone 22 months. They'd had 4 engagements, and they had lost half the division. He called me up. I had a funny experience getting out of California. I was told to go to a certain office on the Marine base, and there was a transportation person there that I would talk to, and he would make arrangements for me to get to Chicago, where my family was living. And so I went up to this office, and this man said, well, we're putting together a train. It'll be about 2 months. And I said, you got to be kidding. I'm going to sit here all by myself for 2 months. Well, he said, we have to do these things, you know, like the services. In due time, the train will be ready. And I just sat there in this man's office. And finally he said, oh, well, all right. And he picked up the phone, and he got me an upper berth on a train that was going to be leaving in a matter of days out of Los Angeles. My parents had a very good friend who lived in Los Angeles. I'd known her all my life, and I was very fond of her. So I went up and stayed a night, or maybe two, I don't remember, with her, and got on the train, went to Chicago. And I'd gained 25 pounds in the 4 months that we lived in at Del Mar. We had ration books, you know, and I wanted to have food for Ben when he came home. So I sort of served, and I didn't know how to cook. I'd never cooked in my life. So I ate a lot of peanut butter sandwiches. So my sister burst into tears when she saw me. And I settled in with the family. She was pregnant, and so there was a baby that came shortly thereafter. And I got a job working in, there were four doctors in an office, and I was a receptionist. And one of the doctors was Dr. George Gardner, who was the chairman of obstetrics and gynecology. And he...
At Northwestern.
At Northwestern. Mm-hmm. And so... After I was there for a while, and then I can't remember, maybe they got tired of me. I was sort of useless. I didn't even know how to type. And then my father hired me in their law office downtown on Randolph Street. It was really very interesting to be downtown. Mm-hmm. And because I'd lived in Chicago all my life, but of course I had just gone to the dentist and stuff down in the loop. So this was very interesting. And then my sister had such terrible hay fever that it was decided that she should, and of course there weren't any antihistamines in those days, so it was decided that she should be, that she and the baby and I should go up to up in Michigan, what was the name of the town? Anyway, we went up there and rented a little house. And of course had no car, and it was an interesting experience. And all of a sudden, the war was over. And in this little town, the bells were ringing and everything was going on. And Mary and I decided that we needed to have something to drink that night to celebrate, because her husband was off in the Atlantic. He was a gunnery officer in the Navy, and so. We went to the liquor store, and they were state liquor stores, and the only thing they had left was sherry. So we took care of the bottle of sherry, and I can remember going upstairs. I was perfectly sober, but I couldn't walk. I went upstairs to bed on my knees. So after a little bit, we went home to Chicago, and it was quite some time before Ben came home. I mean, to move a whole division took some time to put that sort of thing together, and they came home on aircraft carriers and things like that.
In 1945.
45, right. And Ben was very upset because he was in the Navy, and as an officer, he had to pay for his food on shipboard. And they had put chicken wire over all the library, all the books in the library, so nobody could take a book out. So they played a lot of poker on the way home. And when they had started, when the division got to, I imagine, Hawaii the first time, they had started a pot of some kind in the officers' club where they all put a certain amount of money in, and that bought liquor. And they got points. I don't know how the thing worked out, but they got shares or something. And so when the war was over and they'd lost half the division, they couldn't pay them in money, so they gave them liquor. So they all started home on board whatever they were on with a locker, a footlocker full of bottles, which I'm sure were mostly consumed by the time they got to their destination. So he called me up from California, and he said, I'd lost 25 pounds, and I had grown my hair. It was hanging down my back. And I had sent him a picture of me. And he didn't know who this girl was. Didn't look anything like the one he'd married. So he said to me, what'll you be wearing? I'll be wearing marine greens. So I went to the railroad station. My family didn't have a car during the war. We traveled by bus or taxi or whatever. My father arranged a car to pick us up. Father had been in World War I, and he had a lot of empathy for what soldiers go through. And so he had arranged a limousine to take me down to the railroad station and then take us back. We were going to go to the Drake Hotel for a couple of days to get to know one another. And when Ben got off and came down, there was this phalanx of families waiting for these people, these guys. And he got off, and he jumped at the woman that jumped out ahead of me. Wait a minute, here I am. So we went to the Drake, and here we were. We hardly knew one another when he went away. And then he'd been gone 2 years, and almost 2 years, and I had gone from a teenager to a woman. Mm-hmm. And it was quite an adjustment. So we went home to see the family, of course, right away. And my family just, you know, enveloped him in hugs and tears and everything. And then we went up to Milwaukee to see Ben's family. Now, Mary Gross was a really wonderful woman. This was Ben's mother. She was on the Civil Service Commission. She was very active in the Children's Code in Milwaukee. Mm-hmm. But she was a woman, her husband had lost all their money, or most of it. And she was a woman who had had a lot of trouble. When Ben's oldest brother had taken over the business, he found that his father had misused funds. And the business was in bad shape, and he stepped in front of a train. This was while Ben was in medical school here at Wisconsin. And Ben had to go down and identify Jack's body. And Ben's grandmother, the one that lived with him, had committed suicide with some of the poisons that she was using for her spiders, for preserving spiders. And her sister, who also had lived with him, had committed suicide also. So Mary Gross had had a lot of tragedy, and she adored Ben. He was more like his grandfather and the scholarly type than either of the other boys. And but she was very reserved. And I'll never forget having gone home with Ben to my family, where everybody was hugging and crying and carrying on. We walked into Ben's mother's kitchen, and she said, "Hello, Benny. It's nice to see you."
And that was it.
And that was it. And of course, we had a fine time, and then we decided to go up to Wild Rose to the cabin. Well, having spent my whole life in the city of Chicago, or else in a very well-tended house down in Connecticut in the summertime, I was not used to a log cabin that hadn't had anybody living in it in a long time. And Cousin Ben was a big game hunter in Africa, and decorating the walls were these heads of all these animals, where the mice had taken up residence. So you'd sit in the living room and you'd watch these mice. They'd come out an ear and they'd tiptoe around and crawl in the mouth or some kind of an animal. Oh my goodness, it was just, I sat with my feet tucked underneath me all the time. There were no screens on, the bats were flying around in the bedrooms. There was a nest of mice in the hot water heater, so Ben and his mother didn't want to disturb this nest of baby mice, so we didn't have any hot water. The days were lovely. It's beautiful up there. I could hardly wait to leave. But we were up there for a few days, and we had a very nice time in the family. Ben's sister was there. Ben had a wonderful sister, Edith. She had two sisters. Edith was the oldest one, and she was 2 years younger than Ben. And she was a very smart woman, and she picked up languages very, very quickly. And she had gotten a job of some kind as a secretary. But after the war, she went with the Army of Occupation to Japan. And she sat with a novel in English and the same novel in Japanese. And she learned Japanese. And after a few years over there, she was teaching Japanese businessmen English. She never lived in the American community in Japan, so she lived with the Japanese people. And she was a wonderful woman, and she'd come home once in a while. She felt seeing us for a couple of days to make sure that everything was okay was enough. But she was a memorable person. There was also a younger sister by the name of Polly, and Ben's mother, we called her Mamie. Mamie had met up with this little girl when she was 4 years old, when she was working on the Children's Code. And they adopted her. And Polly was just different from the rest of the family. And but, you know, she lived with the family. She was married and went off to, I think she was in Albany, New York. I don't know. Nobody ever really kept track of her. She didn't keep track of us either. And but Polly was home and went up to the cottage, up to the log cabin with us and so forth. The property up in Wild Rose was sold soon after that because nobody could take care of it. Ben was going to go into residency, and his brother didn't have the money to keep it up, and he was working too. And I think it went to the Nature Conservancy, but I'm not just sure. That's where it is now. But somebody bought it in the meantime. So back to Chicago, and then Ben was shipped down to St. Louis for 4 months to do discharge physicals on sailors.
Oh, he was still in the Navy.
He was still in the Navy. And so we went down. It was a good thing because it gave us 4 months away from home to sort of get used to one another. We got very used to one another. I got pregnant almost immediately. And so there were days when Ben he'd go out to the base, and there wouldn't be any sailors to examine. So he'd come home, and we'd think of something to do. We didn't have a lot of money. We certainly didn't want to spend a lot of money. So we spent a lot of time in the St. Louis Zoo.
But it's still going very well.
We spent a lot of time in the zoo, and we'd take a picnic, and we stayed first in a hotel, but we realized that was too expensive. We couldn't do that. So some friend of my father's was in the real estate business, and he got us an apartment and a building, which was a real experience. The apartment was absolutely loaded with roaches, cockroaches. And because the friend put in a good word, they sent a painter in to paint this apartment while we were in it. And it was just grand to watch this painter. There'd be cockroaches on the windowsills. He'd just paint right over them, paint them right in. Into the windowsill. It was different. We'd get one of those bombs, and we'd set off the bomb, and then we'd go to the movies, and then we'd come back and sweep up all these dead bugs. Oh my. So we.
Can I ask you, as part of getting reacquainted, did Ben talk at all about the war or any of his experiences as a surgeon to you?
He talked a lot at first. It was kind of as if he didn't talk at all to his mother about it. And interestingly enough, he didn't talk to my father, who was dying to talk to him about it. At first, he just sort of dumped all this out. The things that had really been terribly painful for him. Mm-hmm. He was very jumpy. He was very jumpy for years. A lightning strike that sort of came out of no place would send him to the floor. He'd just flatten out. And there were a number of men that did that, but there was, as everybody has read, this generation just came home and they set their minds mm-hmm. to, with Ben, it was to make up for lost time. Mm-hmm. Because he, when he got down to work at Northwestern, he found that the fellows that he had gone through medical school with were in practice, they were making money, they were settled. And he was just beginning. Mm-hmm. So there was this drive that, you know, you had to accomplish this. So he went down when we were home before we went to St. Louis. He talked with John I. Brewer, who was a wonderful man, who was the chairman of obstetrics and gynecology at Passamit Hospital, which was part of Northwestern. And Dr. Brewer said he didn't have room in his residency for Ben. But Dr. George Gardner said, I want you. I can't take you into the clinical program for 2 years, but you could go over and work in physiology with Ronnie Green. And Ronnie had been in the Navy also, and he was jumpy. And so they were great and very, very smart. So Ben said, all right, I'll do that. And so he had 2 years of, you know, rat colonies and rabbit experiments and chicken experiments and all kinds of things in physiology before the clinical program. And he decided he'd get his PhD. So he thought he knew enough French from high school to make it. This was a man who forgot very little of what he had learned. Mm-hmm. And but he was going to have a hard time with German. So he went down to the Berlitz Language School, and he said, I have $100. I have to learn enough German to pass the exams for a PhD. And they're coming up in 2 months or something like that. And they said, you can't do it. And he said, you don't know how hard I'll work. So they asked around and they found a woman who said, I'll take him for $100. So she did. He passed the German and he passed the French. And when the clinical residency started, he hadn't written his thesis. So while he was on obstetrics, now, granted, it was not a hugely busy obstetrical service, but it was busy, and there were a lot of nights that he was up all night. But he wrote his thesis, and he passed the orals, and he got his PhD.
And what was his thesis? Do you remember the subject?
I really don't. I really don't.
All right.
I have a copy of it. I'm sure it's in the library or someplace. Mm-hmm. Then he went into the gynae program.
And why had he picked gynecology and obstetrics?
Well, I think he decided, well, in the meantime, Sanford Gifford, the ophthalmologist, had died of the flu, a viral flu. And I think that sort of changed Ben. I think he was looking forward to working with Sandy. Uh-huh. And because Sandy was a wonderfully nice man. And after that, I think he sort of rethought. And he must have thought of gynecology all along. I don't know. This was not a man that sat down and told you what his inner soul was telling him. Mm-hmm. So I'm not sure how he came to the decision, but it was all right with me. And while he was overseas, I was sending him books that Dr. Gardner would tell me to send him because I was working for Dr. Gardner.
Yes.
And so when he got into gynecology, he was adept at surgery. Dr. Gardner liked him. I think he was grooming him to take his place at Northwestern. So when Ben had completed his residency, this was 1950, and he was, 35 years old?
34, 35.
Yeah. So we went down to Florida to visit my sister. We had all had the flu. In the meantime, we're living in a two-room apartment in the back end of the building that my parents lived in. It was supposed to be for extra maids or a chauffeur or something. And, of course, nobody had those things during the war. So this was a two-room apartment in the back of above the laundries and the storerooms and everything. And we had Mary, who was born. Ben had been home 10 months when Mary was born. And Roger, who was born 2 years later.
Okay, and you had both of them.
We had both of them in this two-room apartment. And there was it was actually a very, very nice two rooms because they were just like the apartments upstairs. And this was a Lakeshore Drive apartment, so they had nice, generous-sized rooms. And we had taken the kitchen out of what we used as a living room, taken the bathroom out and made a kitchen in there, a little bitty thing. You could hardly get the oven door open. And there was a dressing room. So Mary's crib was in the dressing room, and Roger's crib was next to my bed. And so I'd wake up in the morning, and here'd be this happy-faced little boy smiling down at me. It was pretty tight, but Ben was not home a lot. I mean, he was on a... They were on a rotation that... he was home maybe one night out of three. Uh-huh. So it was okay. We got along fine. He finished...
And that didn't bother you? Or you just adapted to it, his absence?
Listen, he was home. I mean, I knew where he was. Uh-huh. And we were happy. The kids were good, and we had a very nice time. The end of that period of time, just before Ben finished his residency, or maybe he had finished it, but we were still in this two-room apartment. We borrowed my father's car and went out to bring Christmas presents to our godchildren. Their mother had been my friend since sixth grade, and they lived out in Glenview, and we were very good friends. And we were in an automobile accident on the way home, and this fellow came through, a young guy, and smashed into the back side of our car. Roger was 2 years old. He was in a booster seat. We didn't have good car seats in those days. And this booster seat was just on a hook behind the seat and behind the car seat. And that, he was thrown all the way across the car into the side window. So he had a long fracture in the side of his head. And a man and his wife came along, and they took Ben and the two children and went to Wesley Hospital, where Ben was on the staff by this time. And they operated on Roger that night to relieve the pressure on his brain. Roger lost the sight of one eye in that accident. And it was as if he'd had a stroke. His half of him was paralyzed for some time. His eye was closed for several months, but it eventually opened. He's amazing. These people with one eye. He plays tennis. He skis. He's a physician. He gets along well. And I don't think most people realize that he has vision in only one eye. There are a lot of people out there with vision in only one eye. I don't envy them, but... So we then moved into an apartment that was actually just about a half a block away. This two rooms was on the alley, and if you went right down the alley, you'd get right to this apartment building. It was a very, very old building. And they were long, thin apartments, two a floor. Bay windows and stuff like that that were in old buildings. And we were there for, I don't remember how many years. By this time, Dr. Gardner had taken Ben into his office, which was where Saks is on Michigan Avenue.
Uh-huh.
The building was full of doctors' offices. Huh. And Ben had his office there with Dr. Gardner's staff. It was nurses and secretaries and so forth. And he also taught at Northwestern. And he did clinics at the maternity center. And
he was adjunct faculty. I take it.
He was an assistant professor, I think, at that time. No, he was really part of the faculty, but I think he was an assistant professor, but I really don't know that. It didn't make much sense to me in those days, frankly. I was with two babies and wondering what was going to happen next. So we were there until Mary was going to first grade. I had gone to the girls' Latin school as a child, and the girls' Latin school was closed, and the boys' Latin school had become a co-educational school. And so Mary went there to kindergarten, and then when we found out how much it was going to cost to have her in first grade, we decided the best thing to do was to buy a house in Evanston, which was the next suburb out. So we bought the house that had belonged to the pediatrician that took care of my sister and me when we were little kids. And it was a big house on Forest Avenue. It was old. It had 10 or 11 foot ceilings in the living room. You couldn't buy a curtain or anything that fit in this house ready-made. My father went around admiring the brass doorknobs and the various wood trims, and there was quite an impressive staircase of wood that went up and all this. And man, it was a lot of house. I didn't have a dryer. I had a washing machine down in the basement. And so I hung all the clothes in the basement to dry, until, you know, the weather was decent, and then we put a clothesline in the backyard, wash diapers, sheets, everything. And Ben would drive back and forth on Lakeshore Drive, 7 feet apart, 50 miles an hour. And it was terrible. And sometimes he'd get home, and he'd drive in the driveway, and I'd run out and tell him there was someone in labor, and he'd turn around and go back down to the hospital. But it was a pretty good life out there. The children were in public school. I had another baby. Gardner was born. Gardner Green Peckham was born about 2 months after we moved into the house. And he was named for George Gardner and Ronnie Green. We were undecided as to what to name this child, didn't know whether it was a boy or a girl. And Ben came home the night before I was having a repeat cesarean, and he threw this reprint in my lap, and it was an article written by Gardner Green Peckham. And I said, okay, there's his name right there, if it's a boy. So it was a boy, and by the time I woke up, everybody was celebrating this wonderful name that this child had. So after a while, I think we were only there 3 years, when Murray Angevine, who was chairman of pathology at the medical school in Wisconsin, came down. I don't remember if there was anybody else with him, but he came down and interviewed Ben to see if he was interested in being chairman of the department up here at Wisconsin.
Oh, came down for chair?
Yeah. Ben was 40 years old, and he had a PhD, which was, and he, you know, passed his boards and mm-hmm. was looking like a comer. And they needed somebody cheap, so John Bowers was the dean up here, and we came up and looked at the department. Of course, this was Ben's old school. Mm-hmm. He felt very strong connections to Wisconsin. He felt very strong connections to Northwestern. And I think he thought that maybe getting 5 years of department chairmanship under his belt before the position opened at Northwestern, because he knew that Dr. Gardner was taking him to meetings all over the country and introducing him to everybody that he could possibly introduce him to and encouraging him in every possible way, that Ben knew that it was unspoken, but it was there that Dr. Gardner would like to have Ben succeed him as chair at Northwestern. So Ben thought, you know, it wouldn't be a bad idea to get a few years of chairmanship under my belt before that happens or that possibility opens up. So we came up here, and Imogen Bowers, John, the dean's wife, was very helpful to me. And everybody was helpful. They arranged for us to have realtors take us around and look at houses and so forth. And I, living in this house in Evanston that was everything that I did not want, I was looking for some simple little place to live. But Ben had other ideas. The minute we saw this house in Shorewood that was a big old house on a beautiful piece of land, it was, he was sold on it. And it was a gorgeous place to live. It was a wonderful place to raise children. We were on almost an acre of land.
What was the address?
3433 Crestwood Drive. Okay. We were right on the lake side of the hill there.
Oh.
When we bought that house, from the bedroom windows, we could see the lake, but the trees grew up, and now I don't think you can see the lake at all. But the house had, when we looked at the house, the wife's clothing was still hanging in the closet, and she'd been dead for 7 years. And the house was full of stuff. I've never seen so much stuff. So I said, look, I'm not going to be able to come up. Ben was coming up on the 1st of June to start work. And I was coming up on the 15th after the children got out of school. And I said, I can't move in with all this stuff. And the kitchen has to be redone. So by the time I got up on the 15th of June with the three children, the kitchen had been entirely ripped out. They had left a stove hooked up. There was running water. I think we had bought a refrigerator. or Ben had bought a refrigerator. So I don't really remember it all, but there was a hole in the kitchen floor. We'd taken a pantry out where the laundry chute had gone through. Mm-hmm. And I had a 3-year-old, and I was afraid he'd end up in the laundry basket down in the basement. So they finally put a cover over that. It was months before that kitchen was finished. We redid all the bathrooms with new fixtures, and it was all summer that we ate on a card table. Little Gardner was in a high chair, and the four of us ate on a card table, wherever we could set up a card table. In the meantime, the bedrooms had all been repainted and painted and papered, and they looked very nice. And each child had a nightlight in their room. And one night, Mary woke up. Mary was 9 years old. The neighbors across the street would never forget it, screaming, "I want to go home! I want to go home!" And all around her nightlight was the most marvelous array of bugs that you've ever seen. There were, must have been 10 different kinds of bugs around that little nightlight. So, and there were bats, oh mercy, and squirrels running around in the attic, and it was a nightmare. So I said, I can't live like this. So Wilkill came. We had to get out of the house for the whole day. They used, is it lindane or something like that? I can't remember what it was, but anyway, they lit something and killed everything that was in the house. We had to be gone all day. The only place that I had to go with these three little kids was down to the beach. So we spent a lot of time down at the Shorewood Beach. And the kids loved the lake and everything. It was great. And Imogen Bowers and her children came down a lot. The girls were the same age. And then they had boys that were one a little older and one a little younger. And we had a very happy relationship. Then we got the house squared away, but John Bowers was in serious trouble. And Ben was very loyal to John. After all, John had brought him up here. He knew what John was expected to do in the medical school. But he had antagonized so many people that his tenure looked tenuous. Mm-hmm. And the regents were listening to President Elvium, the university president. And President Elvium had a lot of friends in the medical school that were telling him all these terrible things that were happening and how bad John Bowers was and so forth. So It was a very, very difficult time. There were meetings in our living room of the five people, chairs that John had brought in. Frank Forrester was one of the most memorable. Then
what was his area?
He was a neurologist and a very, very famous man. And he stayed here. He and Ben were the only two that stayed. The others all went elsewhere. John expected everybody to resign. And Ben said, you know, this is my school. And my family's happy here. And we're just going to work our way through this. I read in something, though I had forgotten it, that they appointed Ben chairman of the search committee. This was all revolving around the Department of Surgery. Mm-hmm. And Tony Carreri, who was on the staff, had been trained here, expected to be the next surgical department chairman. Old Dr. Schmitz had retired, or maybe died. And Tony was the one that was supposed to take over. And John didn't think he was, in modern day surgery, the best one to take the job. So they were recruiting. And then John was fired, and they asked Ben to chair the committee to the search committee for department chairman in surgery. And Ben refused to do it. He said, I'm going to stay. My family's happy. This is my school. But I don't want to be part of that search. Interestingly enough, the man that John Bowers wanted to hire and the search committee, most everybody wanted, was a fellow by the name of Jack Cole. And he had come, I think, from Cleveland, from Case Western, which was at that time Western Reserve. And he went to Yale, and he trained my son-in-law in surgery at Yale. But it was a very, very difficult time. Can we stop here for a minute? Because
you ready?
I'm ready. I think I'd like to read what Peter Eichmann, who had been one of the deans that succeeded John Bowers, wrote to memorialize Ben at his memorial service in August of 1994. I'd like to read what Peter said about Ben because I think it's better than anything that I can tell you. I'll just sort of start while he's still in Chicago. Peter says he practiced in Chicago and served on the clinical faculty at Northwestern until 1956. At that time, he was appointed as professor and chairman at the University of Wisconsin. Peter's memory begins at that time. He had a difficult task at the onset of rebuilding and reshaping the department. He opened up the affiliations with local hospitals and mobilized the practicing obstetricians and gynecologists to assist in teaching medical students and training residents. For the first time since the medical school opened, it was not necessary to send our students to Chicago for obstetrical experience. The department grew by leaps and bounds, and the training program more than doubled. I remember him in his crisp bow tie and gray clinical coat, different than the white of the rest of us. It became a trademark. His vigorous manner and can-do attitude are keen memories. He understood better than most the necessity of community involvement, even extending to Mount Sinai Hospital in Milwaukee. He served the medical school in other ways. He accepted the responsibilities of associate dean for clinical affairs during my tenure as dean. He was able and willing to tackle the most difficult problems. I remember him as a man of strong commitment, persistence, strong feelings, candor, and honesty. Whenever he set his mind to a task, it was done with vigor. As associate dean, he made a major move in the clinical integration of obstetrics with the community hospitals. This program served the medical school well for many years. He was also a force in the university practice plan. He chaired the consultation practice plan for years and handled some sticky problems during that time. Throughout his tenure as chairman, he set standards of scholarships and research which reflected themselves in the quality of the faculty and the recognition he received nationally. He served on NIH study section of Child Health and Human Development. He was an examiner for the American Board of Obstetrics and Gynecology. He was elected to the presidency of the American Gynecological Society, the Association of Professors of Gynecology and Obstetrics, and the Society of Gynecologic Investigation. He published 64 scientific papers, and as co-author and co-editor of a text of differential diagnosis. He assisted the medical examining board in defining standards of practice as they applied to problems in clinical practice in our state. This was a quiet but effective way of influencing the quality of care in our region. Ben had a strong commitment to women's reproductive rights as he saw them. This made him a public target for criticism for those who disagreed. Undaunted, he stood his ground in characteristic fashion. Right there, Peter is talking about abortion. Ben opened an abortion clinic at University Hospital in 1973, as soon as Roe v. Wade was passed. He felt that this was an important part of women's health care, but it was a pretty tough thing to carry through. He goes on then, after retirement, Ben and Ann led a very active life. They traveled by motorhome all over the country. Sometimes they fished or hunted for rocks from which he fashioned beautiful jewelry. He was an artist as well as a technician and lapidary. He fell in love with computers, working long and hard on genealogical research and other matters. In closing, Ben was a truly remarkable man. He had that blend of scholarship, clinical competence, teaching skills, and administrative ability, which is seen in relatively few. He made a major mark on medical education at Wisconsin, as well as regional and national scholarly contributions. I will always remember him as a man of fire and passion who made commitments and did not shirk in the face of difficulties. He was devoted to his wife and children. All of us have been enriched by this man's life. We shall always remember him. I think that's a beautiful tribute that Peter Eichmann made to Ben. And in addition to that, Ron Olson, I'd like to add a little bit of this. Excuse me. Ron was a resident of Ben's, but let me read what Dr. Ron Olson wrote. I first met Ben Peckham nearly 40 years ago when I, as I finished my second year of medical school.
You ready?
Yes. Ron Olson says, I first met, and this was what he said at the memorial for Ben after Ben died in 1994. I first met Ben Peckham nearly 40 years ago when, as I finished my second year of medical school, he came to Wisconsin to assume the chairmanship of the Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology. The department had fallen on hard times with a small, mostly private obstetrical service and a very minimal teaching gyne service. The program was held in low esteem by the medical students and had difficulty in attracting residents to postgraduate training. Initially, Ben had few resources other than his considerable personal abilities as an administrator and teacher. Within a span of 3 years, due to his strong leadership, the department had developed to the point where it was perceived as one of the best in the medical school by the students and was able to attract well-qualified residents. Ben was a relatively new breed of academic physician with a PhD in physiology and an active interest in research in gyne physiology and pathology. He taught both the science and the art of medicine. He was a unique teacher. For example, every Friday afternoon he conducted a gyne pathology conference, primarily for the medical students, but also attended by the residents. As a student peered through the microscope at a surgical pathology slide, Ben played the part of the patient, relating history and physical findings. While a student playing the part of the physician was skillfully led to the correct diagnosis and therapy, when necessary, he could even play the part of the worried family member. Fortunately, Ben never had to play malpractice attorney since these cases always ended successfully. Ben was a superb technician, widely respected in the operating room. In resident teaching, oh, Bob, this is terrible. I'll get through this some way. In resident teaching, he had the unique ability to assure quality patient care while allowing the residents sufficient responsibility to develop skills and self-assurance. He introduced a variety of surgical techniques that were unknown to the community at large. He generously shared them with the private community by allowing them to come into the university environment to observe and learn long before continuing medical education became fashionable. He was also resourceful. When he recruited our first female resident, one Gloria Sarto, we belatedly discovered we had only a male call room and no place for her to sleep nights on call. Ben arranged for a bed in the infant formula room and probably encouraged more night breastfeeding to safeguard her occasional slumber. Gloria is back at the university here. She became chairman at Northwestern and at Mount Sinai and down in Albuquerque, New Mexico. And now she's back at Wisconsin doing wonderful work. Without question, one of his greatest accomplishments, was the cooperation he developed between town and ground. Teaching patients were scant when he arrived, and he was farsighted in perceiving that if the patients were at the private hospitals, it was essential to form affiliations with these hospitals and their practicing physicians. He recruited volunteer faculty interested in teaching from the staff of these hospitals and sent medical students and residents to the hospitals for significant portions of their training. Because of his characteristics of leadership and integrity, he was respected by the private community and the affiliated programs in both obstetrics and gynecology became very successful and a model for other departments to emulate. I doubt that a lesser person could have held together such a varied group of opinionated physicians. And certainly it is to Ben's credit that the program has grown and survived to this day. Ron goes on to say, Ben Peckham was my mentor as a medical student through my years of residency training and throughout my years of practice. I've also had the opportunity to observe innumerable students and residents pass through his program over the years. And as in my case, I know they have all benefited greatly, both professionally and personally, from having come in contact with him. Ben was sorely missed when he retired from the department, and now even more so following his recent untimely death. I'm not sure where Ben is today, but I'll bet wherever he is, he's already working on making it a better place than before he came.
Oh, that's nice.
Isn't that nice? Yeah, that was very, very nice. These are very nice, and I don't know whether you want them in the record, but I think they're... I'm going to make copies of them.
I have to say one thing. This now concludes the first session with Ann Peckham.